With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Well, I got my heart up in a beautiful mess. I should have known better when I took the risk. I had to wreck myself and a gamble I broke. Yeah, shaking something mental, I lost for the words I once held.
So Chuck, I want to tell you a little story before we get into this.
Okay.
I had Tim from Rise Against on the show a couple of months back, and he recalled a time way back in the day when his first band, way pre-Rise Against, opened up for Hot Water Music.
Baxter.
That was it, in Chicago. Yeah. And he said, and the thing with Chuck is, now I'm friends with him, and years down the line, I mentioned it to him. I said, oh, by the way, years ago, my band Baxter supported you in Chicago. And you said, yeah, I remember, I've still got the 7-inch. And he was like, no, you don't. You don't need to say that to be nice. And you're like, no, I do. You described it to a T, and he's like, man, he does. Then I made a video trailer of that story. I put it on Twitter to tease the podcast, tagged you in it.
Yeah.
You saw it. And took a picture of the sleeve, and you're like, still got it. And I was like, man, the internet isn't always a drag. That's one of those moments where I was like, the universe just all came together in a beautiful way.
Yeah.
So good.
Yeah, I totally, that wasn't that long ago. I remember.
Yeah,
that.
It was about 3-4 months right at the start of the year.
That's cool.
A man of your word. You see, a man of your word. We did a chat. You probably won't remember because I assume you do a lot of these. We did a chat for a radio station in London a few years back. And after speaking to you then and from speaking to people like Tim and, you know, people that have toured with you and know you, if it's not too much of a stretch, it seems to me like your life's work has been, and your life itself has been, a quest really for sincerity and authenticity and loyalty and friendship and family. It seems like those core values of the community that you're a part of really, you know, mean a lot to you, and you practice your life in that way as an honoring of those things. Do you think that would be safe to say?
For sure. I mean, I do my best, you know. I feel really lucky that when I started playing music, you know, as a young kid, you know, it was more of just a pure rebellion, you know. It was something my parents didn't support. And I battled everyone and everything around me, you know.
Where do you think that came from?
Just, I mean, I think it's just part of growing up. Every kid goes through,
sure,
you know, in those early, early years where, you know, you're still a bit confused as to where you fit in. You know, you're, if not completely confused as to where you fit in. And nothing around you makes sense.
Yeah.
In terms of what people are trying to teach you or tell you or, you know, and every once in a while somebody may say something that'll bend your ear enough to make you think. And but for the most part, for me, I mean, as a young kid growing up, you know, religion was really pushed on me, and it didn't feel right. And so I fought the church, you know.
Was that from one of your parents?
Yeah, sure. And, you know, I grew up in religious and Christian schools, and, you know, I fought the authority. I just rebelled against everything. And, you know, I found skateboarding at a young age and all the music that came along with it.
Punk rock, early thrash, hip hop, all of that.
Yeah. I mean, back then, you know, I mean, we're talking like late 80s. So it was just a big melting pot.
For sure. Yeah. Beastie Boys, Metallica.
It was Beastie Boys and Bad Brains and Megadeth and Metallica and Minor Threat. I mean, like whatever. And, but it all registered to me and it all made sense. And that was what kind of pulled me into wanting to play music. You know, I realized that there was like expression in the rebellion. You know what I mean? Like, you know, the
purpose to it.
A purpose, yeah. You know, because the rebellion I felt was extremely lonely and very, you know, I felt alone. And I found that, and I found some unity in that. I found like-minded people and people that felt the same way. I would read lyrics, you know, that registered to me and made me feel the same way. Well, years later, I kind of, you know, not too long, but a few years later, I feel lucky that I met some people who taught me and showed me that, like, playing music and being in a band, because I never even thought about being in a band then. It was just more about, I just want to turn everything up as loud.
Tapped into that energy, yeah.
You know, just beat on the thing until I can't feel my fingers anymore, yeah. You know? And, I mean, not much has changed in that aspect. But, I mean, I met some people who taught me that being in a band was, and playing the music was, there was a lot more to it than just, you know, than just being in a band or being popular or being, you know, making money or meeting girls or whatever the other people, other kids that I was around were in bands, the reasons that they were in bands for, you know. You know, these people taught me that music was about therapy, or could be about therapy, you know. So to me, all of a sudden, everything kind of turned where it wasn't so much that my mind was set on rebellion, it was just set on becoming a better person, you know. And I mean, I'll be the first one to admit I've made just a boatload of mistakes throughout my life, you know, but I look back on it all and I can't have any regrets whatsoever. You know, I'm really comfortable and I feel a lot of joy for where I'm at now. I have a beautiful wife and a wonderful son, and I love my life and I love my friends and I love the music that I'm a part of and the community that I'm a part of. And I feel if I made any decision differently, even through all the rotten paths that I took, you know, in those days, that, you know, it could be different, you know. So I can't, looking at it that way, I can't have any regrets at all. But, you know, when I found that playing music could be a way to overcome my own battles and my own obstacles, it just opened up a entire new world to me. And yeah, it changed my life forever.
When you say you were sort of battling demons, was it beyond the typical teenage angst, isolation, or was there something more going on? Were you battling something a bit more deeper and more profound? And if that was the case, was it music that brought you back from the brink and gave you purpose and direction?
I mean, I can't really say it was any deeper or more profound than the teenager sitting next to me. You know what I mean? I feel everybody has, you know, their own moments growing up where they literally feel like it's the end of the world, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's a part of growing up. And I think it's important to kind of feel that and understand that and for us to find our own way out of it, you know. It's part of maturing and it's part of, you know, coming to realization and becoming a young adult, you know. So no, I mean, to me, you know, in the grand scheme, I look back and, you know, compared to It was all first world problems, man. I mean, compared to, you know, the grand scheme, like, I had it pretty damn good. You know, I mean, I had two loving parents who were wonderful to me for the most part. You know, there were times where they definitely didn't support what I wanted to do. And there were times where, yeah, they may have been wrong in disciplining me or, you know, kind of trying to veer me away from something that I wanted to do that may have been not so bad or positive. But when I look back on it, especially now being a parent myself, I understand that, you know, their primary goal was just to care for me and try to keep me safe
and on the right track.
Yeah. And, you know, avoid pitfalls, you know what I mean? And I mean, my mother said it when I was a kid, like, I don't want you in bars. I don't want you playing this punk rock. I don't want you playing rock and roll. It's a dark path. And it'll just lead you to a dark place.
Because at that time, it was revered and kind of, it was like a threat, wasn't it? Still, music then had that danger element to it.
Yeah, it was definitely not mainstream at all.
And punk rock at that time was sketchy and dangerous,
wasn't
it?
It was sketchy. It was very dangerous and very violent. And you know, I mean, In a lot of ways, I can't blame her one bit. You know, if my son brought some of the kids home that I brought home to my parents, I'd be like,
no way,
get that kid out of my house, and you're not hanging out with him anymore. And I don't blame them one bit. You know, they were just looking out for me. But right around that same time, you know, fast forward a few more years, like, everything started changing a little bit in the music that we were listening to, and you know, more bands started coming out that were really, you know, how could I say it without pissing somebody, like, bands I feel started speaking for change rather than just screaming at it, you know what I mean?
So you went from, say, the Germs and that nihilistic, destructive kind of style to someone like Henry Rollins, or beyond that, Ian MacKaye and people who...
Rites of Spring. Yeah, whatever. You know, something that...
How can we make things better?
How do we get better as, like, as a whole, as people, you know? And, it was definitely groundbreaking, you know, for me personally, but me and then this small group of friends that, you know, we just kind of found each other, you know.
Who were there bands on the local scene that were sort of your, maybe idols is too much of a bigger word, but obviously you've got on the national scale the, you know, well-known, well-revered, popular bands. Were there any local bands that made an impact on you and showed you the way, like, oh, maybe we can do it like those guys and they're onto something there?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, when we lived in a small town, you know, when I started playing a lot in on the west coast of Florida called Sarasota. And there were a few little bands, you know, but it wasn't until we moved to Gainesville that, you know, we started, you know, hearing more bands around us. And I mean, there was a ton of them, you know, Grain and Panthro UK, United 13 and Spoke, and, you know, a lot of these bands that we looked up to, but in the grand scheme, they, you know, some of these bands started, you know, a year or 2 years before us, you know, but they, in our mind, those were our elders, you know. Yep. They were maybe a year or two older than us, you know.
A year's a long time when you're a teenager, though, isn't
it? Oh yeah, for sure.
It's a lifetime.
And then, but I think one band, and I mean, it's perfect to talk about it now because we have him here tonight, but probably one band that made such a massive impact on us at an early age was Avail.
Right on.
You know, they were a band that we were fans of them just because they had the right message and they had the right energy, and, you know, they were just dirty and gnarly and relentless and great live shows. They had everything that we were looking for. So we were fans. We loved them. And then they would come to town and we would meet them. And, man, we just hit it off like nobody's business. And
so how long have you known Tim? We're talking like 20-odd years, longer.
Well, I would say probably at least since 1994.
So coming up on 25.
Yeah.
Wow.
94 probably is when we first met. And so they're from Richmond, Virginia. And later on, we kind of found out that, and we used to say that Gainesville, Florida and Richmond, Virginia were kind of these sister cities. And a lot had to do with some of the bands that we had met on the road and, you know, brought home, like Anberetta, were all just brothers of ours. Inquisition, of course, who, you know, became Strike Anywhere later on. You know, Action Patrol. I mean, there was a ton of incredible Richmond bands, but we would go back and forth, and it kind of became this second home to us, and vice versa for a lot of the Richmond folks. They would come down, and you know, so, but Avail was one of those bands that, you know, we were fans of them, and then we get to know them, and then all of a sudden, you know, we're kind of looking up to them as like, how do we do this, you know? They became our kind of our big brothers, you know, in the music community. And we would see them go overseas, and, you know, a couple of other friends, bands of ours that we knew of that would go overseas, and we'd go, wow, can we do that? You know, it's like, oh yeah, you know, all we need to do is get a passport, and we call this guy, you know?
Well, so, you got to tour, right? Just before the internet and cell phones really changed the whole game.
Oh yeah.
And you came up in that time when you had to, I guess, get credit cards and call from payphones and like,
oh, yeah,
map,
yeah,
out that route. Like, yeah, what an exciting time to be, yeah, in a touring band.
Yeah. It was exciting, but it was a ridiculous amount of work, and it wasn't always pleasant at all.
I can believe it.
It was constantly exciting, but you know, we did the first few tours through, we had no agent. We booked everything ourselves. And there used to be a book that used to circulate called Book Your Own Fucking Life. I don't know if you remember that book, but it was basically like the internet before the internet. It was almost like a phone book of all the venues, all the promoters, and even
crash pads,
yeah, restaurants, you know, safe places, you know, for punks. And we used to just go through that book, and we'd go, okay, we need a show in Atlanta. And then we'd go down and be like, okay, Car versus Driver House. All right, call them up. And sometimes it would take 12 phone calls to, because not everybody had answering machines either back then.
That's it, yeah.
You know? So some people did, or you would leave a message, and then whoever you were calling happened to be on tour for 8 weeks themselves.
Yeah.
So you never heard back. But we would book, I mean, some of those first tours we did, I mean, sometimes it seemed like, you know, maybe 60% of the shows would happen, you know, and another 40% or sometimes more, you would show up and it would just be non-existent. There would be no one there, and it's closed, and I guess this is it now.
And then you have to just bunk down for the night and then, yeah, drive on to the next place with, yeah, zero gas money, right?
Or what wasn't uncommon back then, I remember a story. We showed up in Hot Springs, Arkansas, and the show was canceled, and we're sitting there, vans on the side of the road, and back in those days, I mean, no one had any money, and we would just pool our money, and we would go buy a couple loaves of bread and a big jar of peanut butter and a gallon of water. And that was lunch and part
for
of dinner.
Yeah.
Yeah, for everybody. And we would just kind of do whatever we could and sit around and have our... And we're on the side of the road and we're eating our peanut butter sandwiches. And this little kid comes skating by. And I remember he was great. And I skated and a couple of us did. And he comes skating by and he sees our board. And he's like, hey, man, you guys in a band? And he was probably you know, 7 or 8 years old, you know, and lived around there. His name was Bear. And we're like, yeah, show's canceled and whatnot. And he goes, well, there's a place down here my buddy is at and bands play there. He goes, you guys should play there. He's this tiny kid. And he's like, I'll go check it out. And he skates across the street. And he comes back and he goes, they said you could play there tonight. We're like, really? All right. And so the kid goes back and ends up drawing up and making this little flyer and prints a bunch out. And he skated all around town and handed out flyers.
He saved the day.
He saved the day. And we
That's incredible.
We played there at Hot Springs, Arkansas. But, and I mean, that was just it's a great memory, you know, to kind of look back on moments like that where we'd roll into town and, you know, there were many times like that where you would just meet somebody on the street and just by the way they looked or the way they carried themselves or the t-shirt they're wearing, you're like, they're somewhere within the realm of where we're coming from, you know, and you would end up talking to them and maybe you would find a place to stay. Maybe you'd get a show that night or, you know, or at least end up at a house party somewhere where you could get a bite to eat and a beer or something, you know.
And a bed to crash for the night, or at least a floor.
Yeah. Yeah.
Indoors. I mean, what were some of the early tours like in terms of other bands you were going out with? You got any good memories of, you know, bands who are perhaps well known today that you would have spent time with early on and before they broke too?
Sure. I mean,
I'm sure there's cavernous amounts of them.
There's tons, you know.
Any that particularly shine?
We toured, I feel bad even talking about it. You remember Saves the Day?
Of course, yeah.
You know, wonderful band, wonderful people. We took them out on their very first tour. And they were just all super, super young. I mean, we were young, you know. I said,
and they're still real small, aren't they? Like they look like kids
almost,
still today.
They were just super young kids and super green and like a lot of questions and I mean, we'd only been doing it a few years longer, but
Like you said earlier, though, they would have looked at you guys with those extra 2 years experience and gone, "Whoa, these are the Godfathers."
The road can age you kind of quick, you know. But yeah, I remember taking them out and you know, we'd all good fun, but we'd haze them a little bit and, you know, we'd go to the market and, buy big fish and hide them in their van.
Amazing.
Like, you know, just all good fun stuff. But I don't know. There was a lot of bands that, you know, that we toured with that, you know, we would then see, you know, just excel and keep pushing on and going forward. And it was always awesome for us to see. I mean, to us, we've always felt so honored to just be a part of a music community who just cares for the most part. There's always, you know, there's always some rotten eggs in the bunch, you know what I mean?
As with everything in life, right?
As with everything. Yeah, there's always people that kind of, you know, they just don't get it or they'll never really get it. And that's fine. I mean, I think it's important to, you know, have
the rough with the smooth, right?
Have it all, yeah. But for the most part, you know, I feel like we're a part of a community who is very caring and very understanding and, you know, believes in a better tomorrow and is willing to sacrifice everything for it. And, you know, for that, I've always felt pretty damn lucky, you know, that I ended up here and not somewhere else.
I think it's pretty telling. Am I right in thinking that it's from day one, it's always been the same four guys in the band as well? There's never been lineup changes or...
For the most part. I mean, there was one point in time where we went on a hiatus and we were... what had happened? Yeah, we were on a hiatus for a little bit and... we got back together and George was playing drums for Against Me at the time. And we had Dave Ron come and play drums with us. That was the first time there was any kind of lineup change. And we never, we did it totally with George's blessing, of course. And then now here we are, Chris Wallard is unable to be with us right now on the road. And we have Chris Cresswell of the Flatliners.
He's pulling double duty, is he?
Yeah.
And, good
and
man.
Now on this tour, he's doing double duty. So
good man.
He's going to have to pace himself. but yeah, I mean, you know, and again, you know, we're...
But that's still a revolving door where they're always in the band still, and they're always welcome to come back
sure,
at any
for
point.
For sure, yeah. It's all...
Which is rare, I think, isn't it? It is rare.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it is rare.
Because life happens, doesn't it?
And it does, man. And I mean, we, you know, we miss Chris Wallard. I mean, it would be wonderful to have him out here. But again, we wouldn't ever be doing this without his 100% blessing on it, you know? And you know, we've all kind of made that pact a long time ago. But, you know, we release it. That new record, the Light It Up record, and
which is
kind of
ferociously good, by the way.
Oh,
dude.
Thanks, man.
It's so good.
Yeah,
it's
we
so
had a,
strong.
We had a great time doing it.
It sounds like know? It. It comes yeah. across on the album.
We had a lot of fun. But, you know, it was just one of those things where we had kind of mapped everything out, what we were going to do, and we started, you know, purchasing the flights and kind of getting everything set up. And then... you know, some things happened where he wasn't able to make it out anymore. And it was kind of a last minute. Well, are we just going to bag all this or, you know, and then we, you know, he brought it up. He said, well, let's see if we can find a replacement. And we were playing, Gainesville Fest at the time. And I remember sitting at the parking lot, in front of the airport. And I had just heard, I was on my way to Gainesville to play the next night. And I had heard that Wallard wasn't going to make it out. And I'm calling George and I'm sitting there like, am I getting on this plane? Like, do I, because I got to, you know, I have a toddler at home and, you know, a wife who wants me home for sure. And, you know, if we're not doing this, I need to know now. And we just said, oh, to hell with it. We'll just do it as a three piece, you know, and,
punk rock.
And so
getting it done.
So I flew. Yeah. I mean, we were committed. So, you know, I mean, we had a job to do. So we had to, so I said, all right, well, let's do it. And I flew to Gainesville. And then somewhere between me flying from Sacramento to Gainesville, Jason had talked to a few guys. He was talking to Dan Andriano about coming out, you know, backing us up, just playing. And then Cresswell, Flatliners were there. And Cresswell just stepped up to the plate and he's like, yeah, man, he's like, I already know a few songs anyway. And I think he learned like six or seven songs backstage before we walked on and played them. And then the next night we played a second show and he learned like another four songs in his hotel after, you know, the
machine
show. So he just jumped in and was full steam ahead right away. And we, you know, again, you know, just with it all being family, he wouldn't have done that without the Flatliners' blessing. You know, we love those guys and we have so much respect for that band. And, you know, just the fact that we can all do this together and just keep the show going, make the show go on, and everybody's having a good time is pretty special, you know.
It's a dream lineup. Like, for you guys, it's obviously the dream to tour together as old friends, but for fans as well, I love it. Like, it happens a lot at the moment. You see these package bills where everything complements everything else.
Yeah.
And it's almost like mini festivals, isn't it? You're kind of just taking like a mini bill on the road and taking it to the people.
I think it's pretty special to, you know, for the most part, when we go out and we play shows, you know, you're not necessarily going to see us on stage with anyone that we wouldn't be thrilled to sit down and have a cup of coffee with. You know what I mean? Like, most of the people that we're playing with, we know and we respect and we love them. And, you know, to us, it's, why not? You know, if you're going to put, if you're going to be that far away from home and put this much time and energy and finances into doing something, you know, you have to, you got to love it through and through. You know, you got to love everybody who's involved, and there needs to be that mutual respect across the board, you know, when you're working with someone. And, you know, life's too short not to do that, you know.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
How is it for you at this stage then? Do you almost feel like it's a bit of a double life? Because obviously you've got, you know.
Oh, yeah.
How old's your son now?
Oh, he'll be 3 at the end of May.
Right, and he's your firstborn, right? Only child
that's
at the
right.
moment. So,
yeah.
I mean, it must be tough. I've got friends, I'm of that age group now where everybody's getting married and having kids. And all the guys that I'm old friends with say that it's almost unbearable being away from your kid when they're that age, because they grow so fast. It's like you go away for a couple of weeks even, and you come back and it's like a different person.
It's brutal. It's brutal. Yeah. I mean, I don't do any long tours anymore. I mean, I'm rarely gone more than a week and a half.
For that reason, is it?
Yeah, for sure. And it's a big reason why I decided, you know, to, you know, start guiding more back home. I mean, I feel like I really do live a double life in the sense, you know, at home I'm a fly fishing guide. Tell us about that.
What's involved in that?
I'm a licensed Coast Guard captain, and I run boats back home and take people fishing.
So are you sort of teaching people how to do it for the first time? Or is it across the board
from beginners? I take from beginners to experts.
Right.
And I run 3 different boats, and I work in about 9 different fisheries.
How long have you been doing that, Chuck?
Well, I mean, I've been running these boats and fishing for years and years and years, but I've been actively licensed and insured and bonded and everything for about 3 years now,
and it's the full-time gig when you're back home.
It is like 15-hour days.
Wow. You know, Monday to Friday or
For the most part, you know, there's the thing about that kind of work is it's, you don't clock in and leave your job and go home. Like, that work comes home with me because, you know, I'm always maintaining my boats. I'm maintaining my gear. I tie the flies that I use, you know, to fish. I'm either on the phone or I'm on email contacting and coordinating with clients, pickups and meeting places. It's constant in the sense that, you know, there's always licenses and permits and, you know, things to do what I do in the areas that I work in, you know.
Has that changed a lot in the same sense that music has, and that there's more rules and regulations and red tape nowadays? Have you noticed that?
Yeah, for sure. For sure. There's still guys out there who do, you know, kind of do what I'm doing illegally. You know, and they're pretty frowned upon, and it normally doesn't last too long. You know, they normally kind of get, you know, pushed. But I love it, man. I mean,
Does it not feel like work in the same sense that touring and traveling and playing shows doesn't, because you love it so much?
Sometimes it's like
does.
The hardest job I've ever done in my life.
Wow.
You know, and some days, Yeah, it doesn't feel like work at all. You know, you show the thing about guiding is you never know who you're going to get because, you know, for the most part, guiding is it's hired skilled labor. It's very similar to being an independent contractor. You know, I used to be a contractor and, you know, I did that for years in between tours and bands. I was a woodworker and I used to build homes. And for the most part, being an independent contractor, there's very little security in the sense that, you know, you don't have this big company or corporation that kind of has your back, you know, or, you know, helps cover medical or helps cover, you know, sick days or whatever, you know.
Yeah, there's no paycheck coming at the end of the month unless you get out there and hustle.
You have to chase it, you know, you have to go. And some days it is, it's green lights all the way and easy sailing and you're getting paid and everything's working. And some days, you know, you put a hole in your boat or there's just nothing but your engine blows up or something happens where, you know, everything just comes to a grinding halt and you have to fix it. You have to pay for it. And you, the sooner you do it, the sooner you're back up and running, you know. But in guiding, you never know who's stepping on your boat. So at the same time, you're almost in this kind of service industry where, you know, very much the same way as you know,
a bartender
or working in it. You like you're providing a service and it's your job to just kind of accept whoever is walking into your establishment and it's your job to, you know, take their pain away and give them the best experience they possibly can have, you know. And for me, it's for fly fishing, for fishing and teaching them, you know, how to do this and how we target these species. And but aside from that, there's a lot more to it in that industry. You know, a lot of people, I get a lot of messages still where people contact me and they're like, how could you kill all these fish? You know, and the truth is I release 99.9% of every single fish that comes onto my boat. You know, the only reason we ever kill any fish is if they swallow a hook or, you know, something happens, which rarely happens. But for the most part, I'm all catch and release. And, you know, we do our best to provide as little stress as possible on the fish. And it's not that, I mean, I love to eat fish, you know, but there's certain species that I believe, you know, are threatened and that we fight for to try to, for them to, you know, grow and, just become more abundant. But I feel like in the position that I'm in, it's not only my duty to, you know, give people a great experience, a great day, you know, just something that's going to uplift their spirits or, you know, teach them something on how we do this, teach them the art of fly casting, but also teach them the opportunities that we have to make this world a better place in the sense of the conservation efforts that need to be there, that are already in place, but just need more support to keep our water cleaner, to, you know, keep, you know, the ethics proper, to basically sustain this, all the wild places that we all love, that not as many people care about anymore. You know, they're all kind of, in a lot of ways out of sight, out of mind to many, many people. And they don't think about, you know, they go to the grocery store and have no problem buying their food, yet they don't think about where the water came from to actually grow that food, right?
Yeah, you know, absolutely.
They don't think about the purity of the soil that the food was grown in. You know, they're just worried about
convenience, you know, and affordability,
whether it's going to be there or not.
Yeah.
I need that. And to me, there's just such a bigger picture, you know what I mean? And you don't really notice that, and you don't see it, and you don't really see the negative effects that our society has on our natural world, unless you're really in the natural world and you get out there in the wild, you know, and you know, you're floating along and you say, oh man, this is so beautiful. And then you pass by a little cove that has an old gas can with gas spewed all over the top of the water, or, you know, an oil spill or something. And I mean, this is part of why I chose that path, to not only be closer, definitely a huge part was to be closer to my son. You know, when I'm working there at home, I'm able, some days I'm able to make him breakfast and go to work. And if not that, then I'm coming home and I'm playing with him, and I'm able to, you know, make him dinner, play in the yard, put him to bed, and, you know, lay down with him and read for him. And
small but hugely rewarding things, right?
Yes, man. Yeah. But things that I wouldn't be able to do being in a tour bus for 9 weeks, you know what I mean? So, but aside from that, then that is definitely the most important why I decided to choose that path. But, you know, I feel that, you know, there's a lot of positive impacts that come from any individual who kind of chooses to, you know, help protect their own environment and, you know, their own, watersheds. And it's the lifeblood of this planet, you know, and it's vastly important. So
I heard a thing on the radio the other day, not about water but about rainforests and Borneo and places like that.
Mm-hmm.
There's a big supermarket chain in the UK called Iceland that have started removing all products that contain palm oil and saying, we won't sell this anymore, because obviously out in these rainforests, they're all getting cut down, burnt down. All these orangutans and, you know, entire habitats are just being eradicated so they can build these new trees for palm oil to put in everything from, I don't know, sweets to washing powder. Like, it seems to be in so much crazy stuff.
Right.
And this guy was on the radio talking about how he'd been out there firsthand and seen, like, the effects. And I think that, I mean, for me, because I'm not a family man, I don't really engage in the way that perhaps you might with politics and social change, because I don't have that thing in my head of, oh, what about my kids? But the environment is so, I mean, without the environment, there is no human race, is there? And it's the most scary thing in the world, like the rate that we've been just decimating and damaging.
Yeah, I mean,
Mother Earth,
I think
for so long.
It's hard to even picture it. Even it's a perfect example, you know, sitting in a room, you know, in a city.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's so out of sight, out of mind. And yet we wake up and you know, we have the basic needs that everyone has. Is you wake up and, you know, you're thirsty and you're hungry and you need to go get it done. And you know, those are the necessities. And we don't think about, you know, what's happening on the other side of the planet that really affects everything that we need right here, right now, you know.
And once it's gone, it ain't coming back, is it? That's the other thing.
Yeah, that's the truth. And, you know, so, I mean, it's a tough battle, you know, and it's a tough thing to, ignorance really is bliss.
Yeah.
You know, in the sense that, you know, the more you know and see and kind of witness and realize, and when you start to see, you know, populations of species just lessening and, you know, I mean, we have an issue out in the, you know, in the California Delta, where we are, where, you know, we're seeing less and less migrations of striped bass and salmon and steelhead. And then aside from that, the schools are getting smaller and smaller, like the size of the fish are getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And it's apparent, it's like it's shrinking. you know, it's going away. And yet there's still a lot of people who, you know, their livelihood is to catch these fish, and people eat them. And I'm, it's great table fare. I mean, they're great eating fish and I love them. I mean, I've eaten them and do eat them, but, you know, we're all realizing now, and it may be too late, I don't know, but we're realizing now, like, whoa, wait a second, you know, this is there, it's going away a lot faster. Like, nobody ever even thought that, you know,
yeah, there would like be a day
where there wouldn't be any striper here. Well, now it's becoming obvious that, wow, you know, when the schools of fish all used to be, you know, 8 to 10, 12 pounds, and now the schools are all, you know, 1 to 3 pounds. That's scary. That's a scary thing, you know. And yeah, I don't know. It's
I think as you said earlier, it's about making a difference on a small level.
Yeah.
In the immediate area around you, and trying to just do your best.
Yeah.
And then if everybody did a bit better, then
yeah.
That ripple effect.
Yeah. In the guide business, we have a lot of us teamed up with Clean Canteen. I don't know if you're familiar with them. They make stainless steel water bottles and food canisters for camping and, you know, everyday use. And then the sunglasses company, Costa Del Mar, who's one of my sponsors in the guide business. And we joined on this campaign called Kick Plastic.
Right.
And the whole idea was to rid all the plastic water bottles out of our boats. Okay. So anytime I take clients on a fishing trip, or an excursion, I usually take two people. And I'll normally bring anywhere from 12 to 16 water bottles, bring like two cases of water or more, you know, and you know, for the most part, people would, you know, maybe have 6 to 8 throughout the day. And then on a summer day, I mean, all those things would be gone. Well, We started this campaign, and I've been doing it for 2 years now, maybe a little over 2 years. And we made a pact to rid all the plastic water bottles off of our boats. And so what we did is each individual gets a clean and sterilized, you know, 20 ounce bottle full of filtered water. They get it at the beginning of the day, like, this is going to be your bottle for the day, you know. And then I have 64 ounce growlers, like big stainless jugs full of water to refill them. Well, in the past 2 years, it's something, by the amount of trips that I've done and what I normally take, it's something like over 1500 water bottles that I haven't used, you know. And everybody's been happy, and the water actually tastes better.
It seems more authentic as well. Do you know what I mean? It's like you're on a boat. You want that kind of like outdoors experience. It's like you're camping. You know, you don't want a plastic bottle. You want a canteen.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I mean, it works. And it's a little more work for me, you know, than just when I'm passing through the gas station or the, you know, the grocery store to grab cases and go, but
the payoff is that much greater.
Yeah, for sure. And it's I barely even make a dent probably in what's happening out there in the grand scheme. But, you know, it's just, if everybody would just do a little bit, just a little bit to make their surroundings and make the world a better place, that's when it turns into a tidal wave. You know what I mean? That's when it turns into change. And, you know, hopefully it'll catch on more. I've been trying to, not just me, but I was talking to my buddy Todd Bean about it, and I was talking to Clean Canteen about it, but implementing that same mindset and ethic in the touring.
Absolutely. Because, but you think of the waste that goes on.
Oh my God.
The touring bands.
I can't even,
it's crazy, isn't it?
It's amazing. It's amazing. I mean, every stop
we go to. And
again,
it's probably water. Like, that's a big thing.
Yeah, and the problem is, you know, you get 12 people in a bus, and, you know, every day there's 6 to 10 cases of water showing up, and it's there at everybody's disposal. And half the time, people will drink
half.
Even take a sip or brush their teeth with it, close it up, put it down, forget which one is theirs, open up a new one.
Yep.
And it's a one-time thing. It's gone. It's waste. And, you know, the amount of money and the carbon footprint that it takes, you know, to make one of those damn things, and, you know, compared to, you know, I mean, this is new, you know, in the sense that, you know, I mean, it wasn't that long ago before none of us even, or our parents even thought about buying water.
Yeah.
Well,
I remember that used to be the joke that you'd get called like a puff, you know, you'd get, what are you drinking mineral water for? It'd be like a very middle class, like, yeah.
But I mean, so
what's also brand new as well, not brand new, but I feel like there is a big wave and a big change happening is people's awareness and people's sense of responsibility and duty. And I do feel like there's a national shift in consciousness at the moment towards recycling. Yeah. You know, I don't know many people now who don't recycle in their homes.
Yeah.
And another big thing they're doing, because I come from the bar trade originally, is obviously straws are a big thing. Mm-hmm. And girls like to have straws so they don't get the lipstick mark on the glass. And people obviously like to drink through straws because it's better for your teeth.
Yeah.
But now a lot of bars are removing straws from at least the front section of the bar and having them back. So if people want a straw, they've got to actually request one. So bars are doing their bit as well, because straws must be another thing that you know, they end up in the ocean. And
We have, you know, in California, recently single-use plastic bags were banned, which is wonderful. It's brilliant. And I've done a lot of river cleanups and lake cleanups. And I tell you, it seems like about 80% of the garbage and trash that we picked up was always small things. It was either the plastic bags that you get at a convenience store, or when you go in and, you know, you buy a soda and a candy bar and a pack of smokes, and they stick it in a plastic bag and get, you know, and you know, plastic bags, small plastic bits,
the ring poles that go around cans of beer.
Yeah,
that's
fast food containers, you know what I mean? And you know, these are the things that I feel like are really decimating this planet. And I mean, I think recycling is wonderful, you know, but there is also a massive carbon footprint to even recycle.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of argument out there that some people say that recycling to save the planet is actually worse for the planet, in the sense of all the diesel that is burned to operate the machinery to do it and to pick it up, and the efforts and everything that goes into it. Some people are like, oh, I'd be better off just sticking in a landfill, you know, or burn it, whatever.
And so much of the responsibility then is on the consumer as well. That's why I love this move from this company, Iceland. Like, it's up to the companies, isn't it? It's up to the businesses to say, okay, we're going to do our bit.
Yeah. I mean, I love, you know, some of the bars that I've noticed in the States, in certain places, they're getting filtered water systems in the bar that are just public. You know, there used to be water fountains everywhere, you know. You don't see as much of them anymore.
I was in Australia recently, and they're everywhere there. But I really noticed them being everywhere, because you walk around the UK and you never see.
You don't see them, yeah. And I mean, you know, it's, I mean, these businesses are just making hand over fist, you know, selling something that should be free, you know. I mean, it should be. And it is. It just needs to be cared for, you know, and cleaned, just like it was for generations before us. I think that's a great step. I mean, you know, but we're trying to hopefully we can implement this in the touring world where it would kind of lessen the footprint, you know, and hopefully make a little bit of a difference.
Well, when you think about how many bands need to make a living through touring now,
yeah,
everyone does it, don't they? It's not like you make a record and then kick back and enjoy the royalties come flooding in. It's like you've got to get out there and make your money playing shows.
Yeah.
And if every band was to take on that approach, I think, again, the impact would be,
be
incredible.
For sure.
What a good talk, Chuck.
Yeah.
I loved it, man. Can I ask you, before you go, I just want to sort of bring it home again. Tell me a little bit more about fatherhood and how that role has sort of, you know, changed your life for the better and the...
Oh, for sure.
The positive impact of being a dad.
Yeah, it's the most wonderful and terrifying thing you can imagine, you know, all put into one, you know, exciting and terrifying all at the same time. You know, it's just what we're talking about, you know. This kid is my hero, you know. I look at him and every chance I get around him, I'm just overwhelmed with joy and admiration. And it's one of those things where, you know, until it happens, it's hard to even fathom it, but it's where I've realized, you know, this is why I'm here. You know, this is why I was born. And, you know, recently, last month, I lost my father, which was just rough. But at the same time, you know, every time I would break apart, you know, and kind of realize the reality that, you know, he's gone and all these duties now that we have to help my mother and kind of make this transition. And I would get beat up and just really upset. And then I would turn around and I'd see a kid in his underpants with a bucket on his head and screaming and running around tugging on my shirt. You know, I just had to laugh and kind of realize, you know, such is
the circle of life,
the circle and cycle of life. You know, here it is, you know, out with the old, in with the new. And you know, I think my dad would laugh at that too, you know. I mean, it's such a beautiful thing. And it made me just the whole process and being there, I was right there helping out when he was born, and, you know, help coaching my wife and just there holding her hand, and it all unfolded in front of me. And it was the most intense, amazing thing that I've ever experienced in my life. And I'm so just completely overwhelmed with how strong women are.
They put us to shame, don't they?
It is.
Imagine bearing a human inside you for that long.
Absolutely amazing.
And that's just the work getting started, isn't it?
Oh my God. And I mean, you know, there's truly a reason, you know, that they run this planet, for sure. I my respect and my love and my admiration grew for my wife so much more, you know, just during all this process. And nobody ever told me that, you know, when everybody was just talking about the baby, you know. And then, you know, I didn't even realize, like, wow, I'm going to fall in love with my girl all over again, you know. And
well, it's because you've made this amazing thing together, isn't it?
Yeah.
Right? It's like,
yeah,
if you imagine creating a song with someone that you respect and love and admire, times that by 1,000, that's kind of the process, isn't it? Because together, oh, yeah, you've made something out of nothing.
Yeah.
And you made the ultimate thing out of nothing, which is a life.
Totally. And now he's at the age, his name's Grady Joseph, and now he's at the age, he'll be three at the end of May, and I swear, man, between the ages of two and three, the development that happens is astounding. I mean, it's just, it's nonstop, every day, and like we were talking about before, about touring, and it's hard. I went away a weekend, you know, and I would come back and here's these new phrases and these new faces and this new humor and all these things that just overnight, you know. But it's such a joy and such an honor to just have an opportunity. And to me, I just want to do the best I can, you know, and you know, teach him everything that I know and encourage him to, you know, find even more knowledge after that and just keep fighting a good fight and be the best person he can be, you know. That's all we can do. But it's an absolute thrill and huge responsibility, and it can be terrifying, especially when you look around. You know, this world can be a pretty ugly, brutal place at times, and sometimes it's a little scary, you know, because right now he's just living in this beautiful bubble where just everything is wonderful, you know.
And that obviously can't last forever.
Yeah, and that hit me not long ago, where I'm like, wow, you know, one day he's gonna have his heart broken. One day he's gonna have his mind just twisted, just completely confused, you know, of why people treat other people certain ways. You know, when he's growing up in just this beautiful world of just pleasant things and positivity and, you know, the outdoors, and you know, that's a little scary, but you know, we take it one day at a time and you know, deal with the rest later on.
Put it there, dude. Thanks so much for a great chat. Thank you for coming on the show.
Hey, it's my absolute pleasure, man. Thank you.
Really enjoyed it. And very quickly, when is the sauce out and how can people get it?
Oh,
Chuck's
well,
got a new hot sauce coming out, people.
Yeah. My brother and I and a couple of my dear friends, we launched a sauce company in 2014, but we jumped through a lot of hoops, but anyhow, we're finally there and we finally have it out, and you can order it online. The website is southmouthsauce.com.
Southmouthsauce.com.
Correct. Yeah.
A little tip of the hat to the old Cajun family background, is it?
Yeah. Southern cooking, home cooking. And right now we have two sauces. And they're hot sauces, but they're not, you know, we didn't want to do
the whole burn your face off approach.
Yeah, we didn't want to do the kind of novelty, you know.
They're
actually good. I mean, it's good on tacos, pizza, eggs. It's great in Bloody Marys. It's great in you name it. And but we have a red and a green. The red is we call Americana sauce. And the green is a really, really special kind of verde. It's called fried green tomato sauce. And both of them are on the kind of mild to medium scale. If people are familiar with the Scoville scale, it's more kind of like in the 5,000 to 8,000 on the heat level. But so they're mild to medium. And but they're really good flavors and good aftertaste. And but anyhow, we're doing that, and people can order it online. We're hopefully one of these days soon get a distributor over here where people don't have to pay so much for shipping, because the shipping's a little expensive.
Assumedly, people can buy them at your shows if they see you on tour.
Yeah.
You bringing them along to the gigs?
Well, I haven't on this one,
by the time this goes out, the next time around.
Yeah. I mean, that's the plan. I would love to be able to do that. But again, you know, I need to find a distributor over here and figure out how to.
Otherwise, you're traveling over with all your gear and then all this hot sauce.
And shipping a pallet of, pallet of bottles. Yeah. But it's good. But I encourage people to follow us along. You know, we have some, hopefully in this next year, even some more cool stuff that we're planning on bringing out. And, but yeah, I'd appreciate the support. It's all grassroots, you know, DIY. It's good stuff. It's healthy. It's real food. It's not super just vinegar based, you know, but, yeah, I mean, it's actually good for you.
So. And I will say the new Hot Water Music album, it's obviously not brand new, but it's still fresh and it's incredible. So I urge everybody listening to pick that up as well.
Thanks, man.
Is there a new one on the horizon? Or I know you guys like to take your time, don't you?
Yeah, no, yeah, we do. You know what hit us a while ago that's kind of crazy is next year, 2019 will be Hot Water Music's 25-year anniversary. And we're planning on doing something. I don't know what just yet, but it all just kind of hit us recently where we're like, oh my, it's a quarter of a century next year. So that's a long time. So we're going to honor that. We'll kind of recognize that somehow. I'm not sure exactly, but
watch this space. Chuck Reagan, good man. Great to see you. Have a good show tonight.
My pleasure, man.
And hopefully see you again soon. Cheers, awesome. Dude.
I'm never going back. I'm never going back.